Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Disgusting display.
And it starts right now.
Oh, welcome back to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. Today we're excited. We're going to be talking to Diallo. We're going to be talking to him about music and writing and comedy, and he's just a really great guy. It's going to be a great conversation. But Goldie, let's talk a little bit about last week's episode, which is creating quite a buzz, because we did something that we had never done before as writers on this show, where we actually wrote a scene on air.
Cool. That was cool.
It seems like people kind of enjoyed that. But did you come away with any feelings about that episode of us actually doing the writing?
Yeah, that you had the best joke, so I know you had a good time on that episode.
First joke of the day.
Yeah, you got that.
I looked stupid.
No, you didn't. You did 90% of the
thing. I was just like fumfering. I mean, I was just totally naked and exposed. And again, because I've been off on script this week for Family Guy.
Yeah.
And I'm once again confronted by the fact that I'm like a total fraud. I know nothing about writing. Like, you sent me off to write a script. Like, you might as well have sent me off, come back with an airplane in a week. Here's a couple parts. And but it's like, I don't know how to do this. And I'm confronted by this, not just like every page, but literally I'll write a line and it's like, well, that was probably the last line I'll ever write, right? And
then it's just,
there's another one? I have to write another line? It's like, dude, you're on page 9. Like, there's a lot of lines to come. Why is this a shock to you? And it's, what is this? Like, what would they say? I don't know. I don't even know what to say myself ever. Like, I'm in every conversation. There's where I live. I walk my dog every morning at the same time.
Yeah.
And at about at the same time, by the same place, and I encounter the crossing guard for the local elementary school who's getting there at the same time. And right. So we have a sort of Groundhog Day conversation.
Yeah.
I can't even come up with anything to say for that. Every day I'm like, I have nothing to say to this woman. Fuck. Because she kind of says, like, happy Thursday.
Yeah.
Like, she always has a take.
Yep.
You know, right. Like something about the day, something about the weather. And I'm like, I'm the professional writer. I have nothing. I'm like, hi. What? Like, and now I have a script, and it's like these fake people who don't exist. I'm supposed to tell them
what to say.
In these. How did I end up doing this? I suck at it. I don't know how to do it.
Not true.
And
not
it's,
true.
And it, no, stop. I don't know. I quit. I hate
it. He quits. He did it here on air. Well, first of all, here's your first writer trick you should know. You say you're on page 9. Tweak the margins.
Oh, God.
You'll be on page 12 before you know it. It's so funny you say this, Goldie, and every time you say this, I always say the same thing back, which is you're full of shit. But you have had this fear and feeling for years where every joke.
I think, like, there's been a slow onset. You know, I read once that Agatha Christie, you could tell in her earlier books she had this flourishing vocabulary. And then by her last book, she was only using something like, it was like 700 words.
Oh, God.
She was down to it.
She could only remember those.
Right. So I feel like, you know, if I come across a word like griping, I'm like, okay, I still know that one.
Yeah.
Ratchet.
Yeah,
There we go. Okay. That's a word you don't hear too often.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, you think of ratchet, you got two extra words tagged onto the back of it. You got to ratchet it up. You see, then that's longer and it's you're up. On your way. But that's so funny to hear. And your scripts are always awesome.
Well,
so
this one won't be.
Like, I know. You said
this will be the one that'll suck.
And the time before that. Well, that's always very funny to talk about your misery.
So
your
we're doing this podcast about writing. Just so you know, this is like you go into a doctor. There are no diplomas on the wall. And you say, oh, I thought doctors need to go to medical school. And they say, no. No, you just need like a bed with wax paper on it now, and you can give it, and you can teach the class.
Fraud Stewart. I love it. Live in concert. No, you're excellent at it, and please don't tell that to our friends. They're going to stop listening.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
All right, anyway, something that we are both legitimately terrible at. Let's get to it right now. Let's get to Johnny Jokes.
Whoa! From Hollywood Live! Yes, that's right, here's Janice!
No! Boy.
That's awesome.
Okay, well, these are going to be terrible. Here we go. NASA, maybe you've heard of them. NASA is sending a giant 3D printer to the moon in an attempt to build infrastructure using moon dust. Should that fail, they plan to use wishes and dreams. Wishes and dreams instead of moon dust. Here's a sad story. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has passed away at the age of 100.
He gone!
Yes, he gone. Kissinger is, of course, best known for brokering lasting peace in the Middle East for his kooky voice. Couldn't do it in the Middle East. Okay, third of four. A new book about the Chernobyl nuclear disaster reveals that so many men were rendered infertile by the blast that the government had to build them their own hospital. Yeah. It was either that or low-income housing. Low-income housing.
Oh, there we go.
I tried to say it the right way first. I gave you a good look, JC. This is kind of fun
now,
in person.
Chernobyl is how I would have said it.
What do you mean?
You said Chernobyl.
Chernobyl.
Wow.
Well, I'm part Russian.
Oh, is that... So, but I would have said Chernobyl, but I don't know. I'm not Russian.
Da. Chernobyl.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. We'll get Mila back, yeah, and we can ask her. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. By the way, by the amount...
You're saying it wrong or sure?
I'm 100% sure. Raise your hand. You got it. If you're sure. Yes. By the way, by the number of words that my dad mispronounces, it leads me to believe that perhaps I am wrong.
A
man who used to call it a Saburu.
Oh, wow.
One of those Saburu.
Maybe that's how it's supposed to be pronounced.
I don't know.
Saburu.
I don't think so. Okay, and finally for me, thank Christ, This week marks the annual Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. Or, as Harvard now refers to it, the Week of Wax Genocide.
Oh.
Week of Wax Genocide. Second, Johnny.
Okay. Here we go. Well, there's a little overlap here. Earlier this week, Henry Kissinger passed away.
Oh, he gone again.
Sorry.
Yeah.
He gone!
Yeah, his family said he'd been ill and in his final days couldn't even muster the strength to eat, drink, or massacre innocent civilians.
Yes. Yes, reckoning.
Okay. Tiffany Haddish
says
she's sworn off drinking after being booked for her second DUI.
Ooh.
Yeah, she says she's looking forward to a new life of crashing her car sober.
That's good.
Like Soberoo.
Sober.
Nice.
And more sad news. TV legend Norman Lear has passed away.
Yeah.
He gone!
Yep. In his final moments, he was surrounded by friends, loved ones, and that stupid hat. I hated that thing.
I really liked that
I really hated that thing. John Denver's glasses and Norman Lear's hat is my nightmare of a person.
Oh, that is great.
I don't know if Alex can recover from that one.
I love that joke so much.
I don't know. Did you hear about this? Kevin McCarthy is leaving Congress. Yeah, he asked his family if they wanted to spend more time with him, and they said yes after 15 rounds of voting by a razor-thin margin. And finally, Starbucks.
Ooh.
Starbucks has lost over $12 billion in market capitalization amid protests over what has been viewed as a pro-Israel stance.
Ooh.
The coffee giant denies taking sides, pointing out they also have 20 stores in the Hamas terror tunnels.
Excellent. Oh, the boy who couldn't write. The boy who could not write.
Those were the last ones.
Yes, always.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay. We're really excited to have a new friend here. He's someone who I'm really a fan of. He has a show with another person we've interviewed on SiriusXM called One Song with Blake Robin, our good friend Luxury. But he's done so much more. Actor, writer, director, musician, probably missing some things. Please welcome Diallo Riddle.
Thank you for
being here.
Thank you. Sometimes I'll say, hey, sometimes DJ. And somebody asked me the other day, like, why sometimes DJ? And it's like, it's that one thing that I used to do to support myself that I can't quite let go. So I still do it sometimes.
Well, that's as good a point as any to dive in on, because I have a lot of curiosity about DJing. How do you go from playing yourself music to playing music for other people and getting paid? Like
ego. Something tells you that. No, but you know, I will say that the first time I decided I wanted to DJ, I was in college, and I liked going to parties, and I had been that guy who like danced a lot. at the parties. And then at some point I realized, you know what, I'm not the greatest dancer, but man, if the DJ would just put this on, everybody would go nuts. And so I started, and plus I got fired from my term time job at the law library. So I both needed money and more to do at parties. So just checked two boxes that were pretty important boxes to me at the time.
And so this is, by the way, I'm just letting the audience know, this is at Harvard is where this is taking place.
Right. There weren't a lot of DJs at Harvard back in my day. There was one guy who did all the black parties in Boston. So if you went to Harvard or MIT or Tufts, We all went to each other's parties because there weren't enough of us. But if you put four schools together, we could fill a
Voltron a party together.
somebody call Tufts. Where are the Tufts people? We need them.
So you were born in 77, so this is about 90.
Yeah, this is the late 90s.
So like cell phones and email, not, I mean, 90s. So how is this communicated? Just a phone chain?
Oh, gosh. It was, what was a phone chain even then? I mean, what's interesting is that the word got out. I think there were a lot of flyers. I felt like people, you know, you print out a flyer, you tape it to the kiosk.
Voicemail?
You know, on the yard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Answering machines, maybe.
Answering machines, like, you know. I've never felt so old in my life.
So did you know how to do it, though? Did you know, like, I mean, literally all I know about DJing is from the song Two Turntables and a Microphone. And, I mean, is that what it is? Or did you, like, how did you know what to buy and do?
Okay, so let's dive into it. I was going to say, there was one guy, his name was Shock T. And Shock T did everybody's parties because he was a legitimate DJ. When I decided to start DJing, people were like, ooh, Shock T not going to like you, man. It was like, okay, but you know what? I'm going to take on, you know, this Goliath because he was a great DJ. I went down to Roxbury. I remember I bought like four or five 12-inch records. and I knew that wasn't enough to do a party, but I, you know, I cobbled together an hour-long set. And those first couple of parties, I just played for an hour. And then at the end of that hour, I would go back and play a lot of those songs again. Yeah. But that's awesome.
Did you practice transitioning on your own?
Yes.
You totally have to.
My grades suffered because all of a sudden I bought this Gemini Scratchmaster, which I wish I still had. I mean, like, I bet you I could find one on eBay. It would cost thousands of dollars, but it was like a beat up Gemini Scratchmaster mixer. And I applied for my first credit card. I got a line of, I think, $2,000, and I bought two Techniques turntables because that's what one does. I just practiced them, and I wasn't good. I was actually a terrible DJ, but I charged a third of what Shock T charged, and being, I know, I lowballed him, and then because I was one of the students, I actually knew everything that we wanted to hear. So my song selection was actually impeccable. I just didn't know how to blend for anything. And this is, I always tell people, like, when I'll never forget, I was DJing years, about 10 years later, with Samantha Ronson, who was a great DJ and a DJ who I won't say because they're famous now. But this DJ came in and he had his laptop, and he was notorious for being a terrible DJ in terms of transitioning. Like, we used to call him train wrecks because his blending would just sounded awful. But he brought in his laptop, and I'll never forget, he had his song sorted by the beats per minute. And I was like, oh, you can do that on a laptop? And that fundamentally changed DJing, because it took DJs years to figure out, oh, this Prince song matches with this Michael Jackson song. If you had an eclectic case, it's like, this Radiohead song has the same BPM as this Two Live Crew song. Like, that thing took years to figure out.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, with one click, you know, a DJ could have 10,000 songs on a laptop and know this song will definitely blend in some weird way with this song. And so that fundamentally changed DJing. This is around like 2006, 2007, maybe, with Serato Scratch Live. So I'll just never forget that, like, me and Samantha looked at each other. We were like, ooh, the gig is up. Like, this is about to force a lot of DJs out of the industry because, you know, much like print journalism, this is going away.
I'd love to hear what songs were in that first hour that you cobbled together. Do you remember any of the songs?
I do. Temperature Is Rising by Mobb Deep. Resurrection by Common, back when I think he still might have been called Common Sense. You know, it was a hip-hop set. I don't remember what my big closer might have been Hypnotized by Biggie, because, you know, you needed sort of like peak of the night sort of songs. But but I still have all those records. They're in storage now because I just don't need them. But I haven't thrown away a piece of vinyl knowingly my entire life. So I still got them somewhere.
Hot collection. Tip from a white guy: Celebration by Kool and the Gang. Throw that in.
Did you see the Questlove story about Celebration? I think we have. If you haven't, it's really quick. So they Prince opened for them in sometime in the late 70s before Celebration comes out, and he performed "I Want to Be Your Lover," and they liked that song so much that they took the chord structure of I Want to Be Your Lover, and they reversed it. Wow. So if you listen to Celebration, essentially in reverse, you can hear I Want to Be Your Lover.
Wow.
Wow.
What? Cool. I just got goosebumps.
So you, by the time you got out of school, were you DJing professionally? Were you making a living off it? Or it was just like side hustle?
Well, listen, in college, it was a great hustle because you were having fun and you were getting like maybe $150 for a big party.
Probably some status.
And a little bit of status, but really, I was such a bad DJ that, you know, for really people were like, hey, just pay him very little. He'll put the music on. The records won't stop. When I got out to California, I was an assistant at Paramount Pictures. That's a story for another time. But I was supplementing my income, my amazing income as an assistant at Paramount Pictures with my DJing. And eventually I decided, you know what? I don't want to work in TV and film. I want to be a DJ for a living. My parents were thrilled. But I got my first
Like,
DJ
they're not
gig.
Thrilled by TV usually, you know, like my parents weren't thrilled with a comedy TV, any of that. I think DJing would have mattered at that point.
Well, you'd be surprised because it was a sliding scale. When I went to Harvard, I told Mom, Dad, I'm going to Wall, because I was a poor, I don't even know if we were working class. We might have just been poor. I wore the same sweater all the time, you know, to school, like, you know, but I got good grades and I got to Harvard. And so everybody in my community was like, oh man, he's going to be a millionaire. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to go work in finance on Wall Street about sophomore year. I was like, dang, I don't want to do that. So I had my big, you know, coming out conversation with my parents, like, Mom, Dad, I don't want to be a Wall Street broker. I don't, you know, sorry to let everybody down like this, but I will make something of myself. And then they selfishly died before I blew up. So that's on them.
You know, my dad sort of did the same thing. And maybe the last conversation I had with him, he said, it's too bad you would have been a good doctor.
Oh.
Listen, we can. Anyway. I think us in the Dead Dad Club can laugh at these moments because I feel like, to a certain extent, I feel like my father probably died worrying about me. So, you know, like that. That can kind of happen. Oh, such a bummer. But look, I'm laughing at it, folks. So it's okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's because my wife has this thing where she's like, oh, I just had a signal from my dad, or, you know, my dad came to me in a dream and my dad literally ghosted me, like just died and then has no interest in showing me a sign or anything, like just nothing from the great beyond. No little indicator that he's watching. But
I always like to say, I always like to say that, you know, the good things that came to me in life, I think happened in part because I probably had an extra advocate, you know, upstairs somewhere. And that's saying a lot as a person who's generally, I'm pretty agnostic. But, you know, on the same, I also feel like, I guess the reason why I'm not full on atheist is because I just don't really, I don't pretend to know what happens, you know, it could just be the infinite black darkness, right. Or it could be something really interesting. I have no idea, but I will say that, you know, I think some of the good things happened might've been because somebody was making a case for me up there, but we've gotten a little bit off from
I want to go a little further off and then I'll bring us back, but I don't know if you watched the show, The Golden Bachelor or not.
I know what it is, obviously.
Well, there was this moment where these two people and both their spouses had died, and they're standing sort of looking at the horizon, and they're saying, you know, they kind of like asking permission of their dead spouses, and they're like, you know, I think they would approve of us getting together, Billy and Tony. Like, I think they're looking down, whatever. And I turned to my wife, and I said, I think Billy and Tony are fucking each other in heaven, and they don't care about it. Like, why shouldn't they be fucking too? You know what I mean? Like, they just get to look down and approve. It's like, no, why? They're fucking. Anyway,
I think that after death, there's a lot more to do than just sit around and watch this boring show about this. I really hope there's something more interesting going on.
Yeah, I'm not going to be like, I'm glad my spouse is happy. From heaven.
I take an improv class. It's like a bad improv scene where the two people on stage are talking about somebody not on stage. Like, if that's what heaven's like, you know, I don't know. That doesn't sound too fun.
Well, so you're at Harvard, and were you doing any of the sort of traditional pre-comedy, pre-show business stuff of Lampoon or?
No, and if I do have regrets, it is that I figured out pretty late in life what I wanted to do. No, I didn't do the Lampoon. I mean, like...
So you weren't interested at that point? Like, it wasn't like you felt, oh, intimidated by it or not, that wasn't for you or you
I remember
lack of awareness or what?
My friends, including my current writing partner, Bashir Salahuddin, who has done, you know, almost everything I've done in Hollywood, you know, I've done with him. We would sit around and watch The Simpsons all day. And we always heard these, you know, rumors, these things posted on the kiosk about like, you know, oh, if you want to write for The Simpsons, you should really go write for The Lampoon. And I will say, and I, you know, I don't think this is controversial. The Lampoon is like any college team. Like some 4 years are outstanding and everybody's yeah. famous and some years are a little off. And, you know, I don't know who was on The Lampoon when I was there, but, you know, we weren't laughing at it. In fact, there was sort of like an offshoot that was really funny. I want to say it was called like Goblin or Gremlin or something like that, of like some guys who decided The Lampoon wasn't funny and they were going to do their own comedy humor magazine. I don't think it lasted after they graduated, but like we always look forward to that publication coming.
Oh, that's
because we were
cool.
Like, oh, those guys are actually really funny. And I feel like... towards the very end of my college career, maybe my senior year, The Onion started publishing, and we were in
that
tears
was
over
unreal.
It was so good that I felt like it put so many other college humor magazines to shame. So I feel like, you know, everything kind of goes in circles. By the time I was out in LA, like I said, I was working at Paramount. I decided I wanted to be just a DJ, so I left Paramount. That's when my mom got worried because she was like, "Oh God, we had made our peace with Hollywood. Now he's." Just a DJ in these nightclubs. I remember my father dropped me off at one, the very first place I ever DJed. If you know the LA nightlife scene, there's a place called The Room on Cahuenga. And that was when The Room had the entrance in the alley, not even in the front. And he dropped me off in this alley with some records. And he told me later, he was like, "I was never more worried about you that night. I dropped you off in a dark alley with some records and you started knocking on the back door of this club at 8 p.m. So, you know, I scared him. But just to bring that story full circle, as I was DJing, I actually became pretty successful DJing. I became the director of music and talent, which is a fancy title for saying I hired the DJs at the Standard Hotel and the Chateau Marmont. If Andre Balazs was the owner, I yes. hired the DJs, as well as the box talent, like the women and the men who went in the box behind
yeah,
the front desk.
God.
Yeah, I remember when you
friends.
Rejected me, sort of. I
wasn't
going to bring it
almost
up.
Almost nobody.
But, you know.
You'd be surprised how people would show up for $100 just to sleep, you know, in a box. Like, it wasn't yeah. for much money, but there was some prestige to it.
So did you feel when you were at Harvard, like, were you into being at Harvard and feel a part of it? Or were you kind of like distance front? Were you like, this is kind of lame? Was it a window into something?
No.
Or was it just kind of like a vocational thing? Like, I got to get this name on a piece of paper and then I can go do what I want.
No, I told my second grade teacher that I wanted to go to Harvard. So for me, Harvard was the culmination of everything I'd done for the last 10 years in school. I was super excited to get there. I didn't know what kind of Harvard student I wanted to be. I didn't know if I wanted to wear the tweed
right.
jackets and the khakis or be like, you know, some firebrand, you know, dressed like whatever a 90s hippie would have looked like and just been completely anti-establishment. I didn't know what kind of Harvard. It turned out that I was like somewhere in between and my grades were somewhere in between. And even Harvard itself was somewhere in between. You know, there were moments where I was like, I'm so happy I go here. I get to meet this professor who's making, you know, headlines. And there were other times when I was just like, man, this place is really not what I wanted in a college and socially not what I wanted, because I was coming from Atlanta where Atlanta was so black when I was yeah. growing up. Like it was, I think I saw a statistic that in the 80s, you know, when I would have been a kid, Atlanta was something like 80% black. So to go to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where like, first off, the black people are on the other side of the river, you had yeah. to take a train there to see them. you know, like, so everything was weird. Everything was absolutely weird. And without calling any, you know, there were a couple of famous students when I was there. I don't want to call them out because it's such water under the bridge. But, you know, like, they were black, but they didn't associate with black people. It was weird. There was a weird racial dynamic that was going on. That's probably not even a thing now, because you just have to realize that the 90s are a really long time ago. Like, Yeah. For the most part, all the black kids listen to the hip hop and to the hip hop.
To the hip hop. That's awesome.
Showing your age.
The hip hop.
Yeah, the hip hop. But yeah, I mean, like, I feel like nowadays, like, everybody listens to a lot of the same music, you know, as opposed to back then when there was still kind of a balkanization mm-hmm. in the music. And to that degree, one of the things that I liked about moving to California after Harvard, I feel like that's when I really came into my own musically. Was that within literally a year of being in LA, I figured out, oh, I like more than hip hop. Also, Puffy had taken over hip hop, and I wasn't feeling the Puffy Bad Boy phase like I'd been feeling the Tribe Called Quest phase. Yeah.
So you weren't acting and stuff, or really writing and stuff at that point. And so you came out here to do music, it sounds like. And then were you?
I came out because I thought I wanted to do Hollywood. My sister was a casting director. Tom Cruise's production partner, a woman named Paula Wagner, had come and given a speech at Harvard. She pulled me aside and was like, you know, you seem to have the personality. Come to LA, and the second you get to town, call my office. I want to introduce you to my husband. His name is Rick Nasita. He's a partner at CAA, and we're going to set you up. And I believed her. I sold my comic book collection, and I bought a plane ticket. And I said, bye, Mom and Dad. I'm going to Los Angeles. And when I got here, I called Paula Wagner, and I never spoke to her again. Like, talk about ghosting. Like, I never found her again. But I did fall in love with the city. I did fall in love with this place. So I came out here for that. But what I was saying about music was that musically, LA was pretty different. Like, the Melrose Strip is a ghost of what it used to be. I remember I used to go down to the Melrose area, and I would talk to kids who like drum and bass, and I didn't even know what that was at the time, but I was like, oh, this is cool. This is like hip hop sped up to, you know, like a 33 record played at 45. This is really fun. And I got into Garbage. I thought that group was like a very cool sort of, like, it felt like hard. Admittedly, I got into Crystal Method and Chemical Brothers and a bunch of, you know, electronica at the time. And so within a year or two of being in LA, my musical palette had just greatly expanded.
So I mean, one of the things I love about your show with Blake is that I told him it's sort of like the music appreciation class I wish I had had. Because for
aren't
me,
we
music
the cool professors, I feel like we're those cool professors.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
hey,
I've always
smoke out.
Like, everyone likes music, right? Like, everyone says, I like music, but the way I consume it is kind of like, I used to buy an album and listen to it, and, you know, I didn't have good fidelity equipment, and I, you know, play guitar, so I would try to play it. But I'm wondering, like, music seems so meaningful to you. Like, how do you listen to music? Like, when you're exposed to music, because it's hard for me to get into something I don't already know because I'm old. But, like, what are you listening for? Or how are you, like, when you buy a piece of music, are you putting on high fidelity headphones and just, are you trying to deconstruct the mentality of the person, or are you just trying to relate to it on a feeling level? Like, this makes me feel this.
Yeah. I'll say music, absolutely my drug. You know, cause I know that when I find something I like, it's going to give me a rush, you know, and I come across it from everywhere. I listen to so many different Spotify and Pandora and, you know, playlists. I still stream the BBC. You know, one of the first uses I ever, once the internet really started to come into what it was going to become, like around like 2000 or whatever, one of the first things I did was I was like, I want to hear what the UK is listening to, because I was so into Astralworks records, and Virgin Records was still big at the time.
Yeah,
I really wanted to know what they were actually listening to in the UK right now. And I still listen to BBC Sounds, but also I come across music. One of my favorite, most recent coming across a song was, like, I was in bed asleep. You know, I fell asleep first. My wife tends to stay up like an hour or two later than me watching movies or whatever. I guess she had been watching Magic Mike 3 or something like that. I don't even know what movie it was, but it's that wonderful thing where, like, a song is so good that it actually wakes you up. At the end of that movie, they played Don't Be Afraid by Diplo and Jungle. And it woke me up, and I was like, holy shit, what is this song? And I fumble in the darkness to get out the Shazam, and I hit the thing, and it found it, you know, because sometimes Shazam lets you down. You're just like, come on, Shazam.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, I truly, truly, whether it's in movies or, you know, on KCRW or in a podcast, like, I'm always listening for new music. I made a pact with myself when I was about 20, when I figured out that, like, most people in their 40s are still talking about the music that was big in their 20s. You know, most people really just gravitate towards that music that came out between the ages of 15 and 25. I made a pact with myself. I was like, I'm never going to be that person. And trust me, it takes a lot of effort because we don't have the radio to be sort of the gatekeeper.
Right. Because that's, you talk about that importance to you on the show. You've talked about it a few times that there was like the Atlanta radio scene.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I'm always, if I find something that's consistently exposing me to music that I like, I tend to try and keep it around because it has gotten harder. Everything is so spread out. And, you know, sometimes even when I'm listening to a Spotify playlist that I know has millions of followers, I'm like, man, I'm probably the only person listening to this song right now. Like, there is something actually special about just listening to the radio sometimes because you're like, well, at least some people I know are also hearing this song right now.
What's crazy is, so when I grew up, and Alec was this way too, the Casey Kasem Top 40 was like, you on Sunday, you're like, this is what we're doing. Like, me and my brother were like, we're going from 40 to 1 and we're going to sit here. And it was like a big deal when you're like, oh my God, Hungry Like the Wolf dropped to 3. Like, we were like, freak out. And but there was this, my sense, and I think this was kind of true, is like anyone I heard on that was now a millionaire. Like, they've made 100%. It. And this is, and now it's like, every time I hear a song, I say to myself, they're probably broke. Like, they're not making any money. Because my daughter, I have two kids, and my older daughter's starting to get into it. She has these Spotify playlists that are quite good, and I never know any of it. But I mean, if for people looking to discover new music, is that what you'd recommend? Just kind of like let the internet bring stuff to your doorstep? Or are there still like, because, you know, there's no Rolling Stone or Billboard really that is telling you kind of what to do.
Well, okay, a couple of quick things. I'd say I've never been paid by any of these people, so don't think any of these are paid endorsements. But I still think the KCRW does something interesting. And I even get on their case sometimes. I mean, like, I won't use any names, but I was driving down Anaheim with my kids and I was listening to it, and they played James Brown, I Feel Good, followed by Brandy Sitting in My Room. And I called one of the DJs there I know, and I was like, who's DJing right now? This is terrible. Like, I don't know who's on. Like, James Brown, I Feel Good. Is that even a song? I know that it's a song.
Right.
In your hate mail my way. Yeah. But at some point, we've all heard that song far too many times to ever be included. Unless the guy who, you know, with the engineer, or, you know, the guy who played the drums is died today. That's right. To play that song today.
Well, then it feels like you wouldn't feel good, though.
Why are you trolling this man with the title of the most successful song you ever worked on?
No, sad remix of that you put together, slowed down. Anyway,
I feel good. Oh my God, I want to make a joke, but that's going to take too far a walk. I think KCRW is still good. You know, everybody's got their Spotify playlist. I still really believe that if you decide that, okay, I want to hear hip hop or I want to hear dance, the BBC still does a great job of curating new artists. I think it's so important to support and listen to new artists just because it allows, like, you know, some fresh air into the room. You know,
Are you still active as a drummer and collaborating with anyone, or is that just something like that's a hobby?
No, in fact, I would say that the only musical collaboration that I've done in the last 2 years has actually been with Blake Luxury Robin. And we've had some great fun working together, but that's pretty much it. Between the pandemic and the strike, you know, most of my professional focus has been on the TV shows and the movies that we're working on. But musically, we had a show called Sherman Showcase on IFC, ran for about 2.5 seasons. that third thing is sort of like an asterisk. You know, like we created a lot of music for that show. And on that material, I worked with Blake Robin. I worked with Fonte from the band Little Brother. John Legend and Neo and a bunch of artists along the way.
Well, that's a good segue into sort of the TV, film, writing, acting side of your life. So it sounds like you came out here just to kind of, you know, on Paula Wagner's vow to set you up in a lucrative career. She really delivered.
I thought I had it made. I thought I had friends in high places.
Like, so the way I got into comedy was, you know, I always felt, when I was in school, they would give a writing assignment, and I wouldn't do the assignment, but I would do something different. It would be funny, and I would get in general, like, I would expect to get an F, and then I would get an A, because they were like, this is a, like, I would surprise the teacher. But it was something I always kept quiet, because it sounds like we grew up a little similarly, that there was the expectation I was going to do something useful. And so it was like, well, you could be the funny whatever.
Exactly. I thought I was going to be the funny stockbroker. It's 100% right. Absolutely.
What a horrible person that would be. Yeah. Funny stockbroker. But then what ended up happening was I'd never gone to see stand-up until I was 22. And some friends were like, hey, we're going to this night at a club called Rooster Tea Feathers. And I was like, okay. Not realizing I had gone to like amateur night.
What city is this?
It was in Rooster Tea Feathers was in like Sunnyvale, California, or something.
Got it.
Or it might have been Mountain View or something. But not realizing it was amateur night, I was like, I thought they were all professionals. So I was like, these people are so bad. I owe it to myself now to try, because like I know I'm funnier than this. And I quit my job, flew to New York, and started doing stand up. So I'm wondering, did you have a similar experience, like sitting at your desk at Paramount, just kind of going, oh, fucking come on. This stuff sucks. Like, I could do
this. So, very similar. It was actually, I didn't go straight from Paramount to DJing. There was a 2-week period where I left Paramount. And I was like, I'm going to be a film exec. This producer named Paul Hall is looking for a junior exec. I'm going to go do that. And it was in my second week there. he handed me a script. He was like, I want you to read this and give me your thoughts. And I read the script. It was horrible. I'll never forget the end of the script was, it was something to the effect of urban comedy. It was something to the effect of they all hop into their hydraulic, their Cadillacs with hydraulics, and they go bouncing off into the sunset. And I remember saying, if you want to make a movie that black people will hate you for, we should do this movie. And I proceeded in my notes to write, this is what I think should happen in Act One. This is what I think should happen in Act Two. You know, just to try and salvage it, just to try and save it.
Right. But you didn't have a background in, like, you weren't taking writing courses for TV.
You know what was crazy is I had been writing stories as a kid, but I had stopped writing stories sometime in, like, middle school or high school.
Okay.
Wow.
You know, like, in literally in the third grade, I wrote a 50-page story called The Adventures of Royce Riddle. It was about a black guy with my last name who was infiltrating the Nazis to assassinate Hitler. And I never addressed how a black guy was going to infiltrate the Nazis that didn't even
seem like they would catch on at some point.
There were a lot of him in waiter suits, but he was getting closer and closer. And that one made, and the teacher in third grade liked it enough. She actually, you know, she put it in the school library. So I considered myself published, but I had put aside creative writing. I was all about other writing. Anyway, I'm sitting there with this producer 2 weeks after leaving Paramount. He rings into the office. He was like, you know what? I just met you, but I don't think you're an executive. He was like, I'm going to go out on a limb and say from these notes, which I think are good, but he was like, but you want to write the story. He was like, this is not how executives do their job. He was like, you should probably be a writer. And even though I didn't know him that well, it felt like the truth. It felt like he had actually unlocked something in me that I had probably either suppressed due to family expectations or had forgotten was even there.
Yeah.
And so for the next couple of years, you know, I DJed to pay my bills, but my friend from college, Bashir, just moved out to LA. We started writing together. We put together a company. Everybody in the company went on to do great things. I mean, like nobody was famous, you know, but like it was me and Bashir, Wyatt Cenac, Robin Thede, Nika King from Euphoria. Like I look back, I'm like, one day we should just do a reunion special something like that. But like we put together this group. We got all these rave reviews, and then we started getting money from people to do web videos because YouTube was brand new. And before you knew it, we had an agent and we started to have a career. But it all sort of came out of just, you know, one random
conversation. So was Bashir more on this track anyway, or did you pull him into?
Bashir wasn't writing, but he was acting a lot. And in college, he was doing, you know, he performed Othello, I remember. Okay. And he did a one-man play about Paul Robeson. So Bashir always knew. And that is the one thing that sort of drives me crazy is that if I had known at college the way that, you know, I would end up going, like, I probably would have done Lampoon. I probably would have started a lot earlier. But you know what? It's hard to second guess because I kind of maybe needed to do that other stuff to know that I wasn't interested in it. Because I've seen that, too. I've seen people come out here to be an actor and it's a little bit hard, and then they're like, you know what, I'm going to go to Wall Street. You know, I've seen the reverse. So maybe I had to go through what I had to go through, you know.
So what I read was that, like, David Alan Greer saw some of your stuff and hired you guys for Chocolate News. Is that accurate? Because I kind of remember, I was in that Comedy Central world at that time. I wrote for D.L. Hughley Weekends at the D.L. when, like, I went to a meeting with Robert Morton. He was like, I'm either going to hire you for Mind of Mencia or Weekends at the D.L., which now is just such a horrible choice. It's like, look, these guys are either going to hit you with a baseball bat or they're going to, like, fire a gun into your foot. Which do you want? Like, so, but I was also in the David Spade Showbiz show. But so
I'm not just saying it because you're here. I like it.
That was a good show.
I watched it.
I mean, he was funny.
We were there at a weird time in Comedy Central, because I feel like everything still had that sort of like post-Chappelle.
Yes. They were really trying to do that again and again.
And who could blame them? Because, Chappelle's show was probably the last show I literally rushed home to see. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's, I don't think we had a DVR yet. So I think our VCR was like complicated. So I think I remember like driving home, like Bashir calling me like, yo, when you get here, wait till you see this episode of Chappelle. He's talking about Prince, you know, like it was just like there was still a degree of that in the culture. And I love Robert Morton. I actually had I had lunch with him not too long ago.
Yeah.
I feel like that guy brought a lot of really funny, good people into the business. But yeah, David Alan Greer, he saw some of our material like this. And then we worked on Chocolate News for a couple of months. And I will say we were the baby writers on the show. We didn't get one joke on the show.
Really?
No. I always say, like, when people are like, yo, I love Chocolate News, I'm always like, we didn't get any jokes on the show. And if people are like, yo, I didn't like Chocolate News, I'm like, hey, we didn't get any jokes. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But we were only there for about 4 months before we got a call saying that, hey, Jimmy Fallon's going to take over the old Conan O'Brien slot in 2 months. Do you guys want to go out there and be writers there? And so we went and we met with Jimmy. And I mean, like, I got on the plane like 2 days later and moved to New York. And we were literally the fourth and fifth people that he hired. Because when we got there, there were literally only five offices. There was Jimmy. There was the writer's room. There was something called the producer's room. And there was the roots room.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, there was nobody in the building. I mean, like, it was just completely like everybody thought he was going to be Chevy Chase part two and have this, you know, embarrassing late night show that was going to fail. But he brought in all new people, nobody from the Conan thing. And like, it was all of our first shot really to work on a show. I feel like as much as I love Dag and I do, that was 4 months that could have gone in any direction. We were at Jimmy Fallon for 4 years. So
that's a long time, because I know, you know, they're kind of notorious for cycling through people over there. And I know good people who've come and gone, like Anthony Jeselnik was a writer there.
Yeah. Love Anthony. I mean, like, our first crew was like Anthony Jeselnik, Morgan Murphy, Mike DiCenzo, who is a writer's writer, you know, just one of the funniest dudes on the planet. Me and Bashir were there. Like, there were not a lot of people there, but I feel like everybody from Michael Blyton, who went on to direct so many episodes of Southside, you know, the show that we ended up creating for HBO Max, it was, and Comedy Central, I guess you'd have to say. It was a wild time, and I definitely felt like I feel lucky that we were there, because we got to write, you know, Slow Jam the News and History of Rap.
I wanted to ask you about History of Rap. I read that you'd co-written three editions of that. Were they the original ones, or how did that work?
Oh, absolutely. So this is a funny story that relates back to DJing. I was, you know, even though Questlove is on the show, I DJed all the staff parties, like, so amazing. When the Christmas time came, DJing for Questlove, absolutely mind-boggling. Yeah. Like, you know, he just stands there and looks at you. You know, it's like, don't look at me.
It's time to celebrate with Kool and the Gang.
Yeah, I feel like that's like when I sing New York, New York for Seth.
Totally.
Oh my God! So real quick, I was DJing at one of our rap parties, and, you know, WRAP party. Yeah. And I never forget, I played this set that like Jimmy absolutely loved, and like all the writers. It was like a euphoric moment, like early on in the history of the show. And so at one point, his, you know, he pulls us into the office, me and Bashir, and he's like, hey, I want to do this thing with Justin where, like, we start at the beginning of rap and then we do like a medley of all these rap songs. So I went back to my desk. I pulled up my playlist in Serato of exactly what I played to, like, build the party up to that moment.
Yeah.
And I brought him back what was probably like a 10-minute melody, in which case he was just like, ah, yeah, the audience won't know that one. They won't know this one. But they literally rapped the playlist that I had done at the party. So that was an example of like of the weird side career that I had coming back into play in what was quickly becoming my primary career.
But sorry, I have one more question about the process of that. So the way they seamlessly go from one song to another, did you cut the songs together, edit it, they practice it, and then Questlove arranged it?
Yeah, or like- so we did the 10-minute version with Quest. Somewhere on my laptop, I still have a version where me and Bashir are doing all the Jimmy. I usually did Jimmy. Oh, I'm sorry, Bashir did Jimmy. I think I did Justin. And then, you know, me and Quest were like, yo, they ain't never gonna do this. This is way too crazy.
And they did.
You know, we had some wild songs in that original mix.
Okay.
And then Jimmy heard it and he loved it. And then we went back to the roots room and we cut about 60% of it out to make it go. And then we brought in Jimmy and Justin. When you work at a show like that, every guest star requires something different. Like, so for, you know, if it's Gwyneth Paltrow, you got to do maybe a lot of coaching. For Justin, he was just like, where's the sheet? All right, let's do it.
Like, that's awesome.
He whipped through it the first time. But Bashir tried to give him one note.
Uh-oh.
I probably shouldn't even say it. I'm going to say it. He tried to give Justin a note. Justin just looked at him and Bashir just said, okay. And I was just like, I love that you tried to give him that note, because I think you're right, but that's what's probably thinking. I do this for a living.
That's awesome.
It was one of those interesting days, I got to say, folks. I'd love to. One time when we're not recording, I'll tell you some messed up history of working with some questionable guest stars. But overall, it was fun working with Justin. And when we got out, when we stood it up in front of the audience, it just. It crushed the first time.
Really,
and I'll tell you, the only other time that it went so smoothly after one rehearsal, because we only had to practice History of Rap one time, was Slow Jam in the News with Barack Obama. We wrote all of the Slow Jam in the News. In fact, the first couple of times we did Slow Jam in the News, it was a different song every time. So every time we were going to Slow Jam the News, I would get down there with Quest, and I'd be like, should we make this one sound like an Usher song or more like a Teddy Pendergrass song? Like, it was like creating a song every single time. Eventually, we always went back to that same medley because it worked too well. And sometimes we didn't have a lot of time to rehearse. But when we did it with Barack Obama, I'll never forget. We obviously, he's the freaking president of the United States. We had one time to go over it with him and he didn't even attempt it. You know what I mean? Like, he was just like, well, why don't you guys do it? And then, like, we were like, okay, well, here we go. And we said, and he's like, okay, I got it. And I swear to God, he got out there and he did it absolutely perfectly. And I was just like, this man could have been a comedian. His timing is just so freaking on point.
What's it like to meet a president? Because I feel like now if the president wants to meet you, I might go like, I don't know, I'm a little busy. Obama was sort of the last one where I would be like, oh my God, like this is the president.
I remember,
so what's that moment like?
I was in LA one time when when Clinton was walking a line and he shook my hand. I was like, that was super cool. And then years later, I was at a restaurant with my pregnant wife and Bill Clinton walks in with the security detail. And he points to my wife and he's like, when's the baby due? And we're like, it's doing 2 months, 2 months. He's like, oh, it's not long before they go from that to Chelsea. Enjoy these times. And I was like, what a fucking cool guy. Like, you know, like, I was like, I pointed to our friend who was with us, my wife's girlfriend. I was like, sleep with him. He's the most amazing man on the planet.
He deserves it.
That's what he wants. And by the way, she was like, oh, I'm on board. Like, it was crazy, but to meet Obama, and it's only happened twice, but this was the first time. The second time, we were just in a lineup for you know, taking pictures, and it didn't feel as special. The first time was to coach him through Slow Jam the News, and one second you're in this room, and there's nobody but me, Bashir, Jimmy, and Tariq, you know, Black Thought from the Roots. Nobody, no chairs, no. It's like a gray room, and then. In come 20 of the biggest dudes you've ever seen in these men in black suits. And then right there in the middle of them, just sort of bouncing along, is Obama, who by no means is short, but he's not like this freight truck of man that I don't even know where they grow these people. And then he just came over and he was like, Jimmy, how you doing? Black Thought, good to see you. And he's like, these are our two writers who write Slow Jam the News. He's like, this is you know, Jimmy's the ultimate host, you know, always a host. He's like, this is Diallo and this is Bashir. And he's like, Diallo and Bashir. Those are your names, huh? I can't quite remember. He made a joke.
Were you like, you're Barack? It's not like that.
That was the joke. Exactly. That was the joke he was trying to make. I wish I could remember exactly what he said, but you know, the light behind his eyes knows. It was clear that he knew exactly what he was saying.
Okay.
And we had like 15 minutes with him, and it was great. And it was one of those times where you're like, I'm going to try and remember this because I'll probably be talking about this to some grandkids someday.
So when something goes viral like those things do, do you feel, you know, is there the sense of like, God, I wish it could be me? Or is there the like, this is so awesome? Or is it like, now how do we top it? Or is it just like, let's take a victory lap or some combo move? I've never had anything really like catch on like that. So
I will say, I think early on we were like, how do we top it? You know, I remember a couple of weeks after that one went viral, somebody came to us and was like, okay, now our guest is going to be Madonna. How do we break the internet? You know, like, you really can't plan for it. Our little show, Sherman Showcase on IFC, to this day, just over the weekend, a clip from that show got millions of views because people always think it's real. It's a song called Drop It Low for Jesus. And it was brought to us by Bashir's sister had this idea that she pitched us the room. She was like, hey, what if on the, because Sherman Showcase is, if 30 Rock takes place at SNL, Sherman Showcase takes place at Soul Train. So a lot of the clips just look like a dance show where someone got on stage and performed. And this was an original song. All the songs on Sherman's were original. There's an original song called Drop It Low for Jesus. And the idea is that, hey, if you can drop it low for all these, you know, men out here, you can definitely drop it low for him. And I swear, every couple of months, some church group or some just group of people discover this clip, think it's real. And then I have the greatest time reading the comments because it's like, oh, these people going to hell. And like, oh, no, I can't believe they did this. And then every now, you know, a couple of people will be like, oh, this is so funny. And then I always get in the comments. I'm like, it's from a comedy show, you guys, you know. But I really don't think you can plan virility. I just don't think, because too many people have tried. And I think even more than anything, TikTok has even shown that, you know, sometimes it helps that there is nobody famous attached to the viral moment. Like it's more viral if people think it's legit or just a, you know, just a person with a phone, you know, like I don't think you can ever plan. I think you just got to be happy when something does go viral. I don't think there's any way to plan for it.
So how did you then, you know, you being sort of a host's, I don't want to say favorite, but being sort of a valuable member of a late night team is pretty intoxicating. Like, I mean, I felt like Alec and I had that experience on Kilborn.
To a lesser degree.
Lesser degree, obviously. And fewer people watch the show. But it was like we were in with the host and we got our stuff on the air. And what made you decide to like move on from that? Or what did Hollywood start calling? Because it's like, oh, these are the guys who did this. And now it's time to like see what else they got.
I think it was... Well, first off, I think we never, despite our successes there, we never felt like, we always felt like we were two weeks away from getting fired anyway. You know, like you could be very popular on the Tuesday show, have something on the Thursday show that bombed and just be like, oh.
Were you writing the monologue fired. As well? Like, because
no,
I know.
That was a total, no, okay. That was a different group of writers.
Okay.
Jeremy Bronson and John Ryman. And we had a bunch of really talented monologue writers who.
Because I heard that's a pressure cooker, that monologue.
Oh, that's
is
terrible.
Like 80, 100 jokes a day, which is like obscene.
Whoa. I mean, and if you write something that's particularly a stinker, you know, someone might ask, well, who wrote that one? You know, like, it's kind of crazy. But we were what they would call the sketch writers. And that was. You know, bits at the desk and things at the, you know, on the stage. So,
and were you
we had
directing
a lot of fun.
Those as well? Like when it
sometimes,
was
sometimes, sometimes, yeah. You know, Michael Blyden directed a lot of them. And that was one reason why we decided to work with him on Southside. But I do think that it's a pressure cooker, it's a grinder. After 4 years, we were definitely ready to move on and do something else. We had become, I wouldn't say friends, but like we had definitely caught the attention of Lorne Michaels, and we were like, hey, we have an idea for an HBO show. So we pitched HBO a show. They liked the idea. They kind of bought it in the room. And so we were like, we want to move back to LA where, you know, sort of our, you know, our livelihoods are. So we moved back to LA.
Was this Southside or was this something else?
No, this was something that unfortunately I don't think we'll ever, unless it gets leaked. This is something that started off its life is called The Reporters. And then it became Brothers in Atlanta. So we spent 4 years at Fallon, sold this idea to HBO. We were like, we're out. Thank you, Jimmy. Moved back to LA. Spent the next 4 years in development with HBO. And and that to me is like the hard times, like because you know I already had two kids, and I, you know, in my time at Fallon I got married, we had two kids. LA was definitely cheaper than New York, but like development money is thin. So to spend 4 years trying to do that, that was really tough. I think that, you know, and by the way, at the end of that 4 years, we came out of it with two pilots and no show. So yeah. It was really like a time for, you know, us to take a step back and try and figure out what we're going to do in lives. But around that time, I did end up, you know, becoming a recurring character on Silicon Valley. Bashir was recurring on Looking and eventually Glow. I got a job on an NBC show called Marlon, where I played Marlon Wayans' best friends. Like by hook or by crook, we started doing all this acting. And then we were able to go back out and pitch again. And so we were like,
you kind of blow past that, but like there are people who are just trying to act and they go to acting school and it just sounds like you people just liked you and were like, hey, can you, you know, do it or what? Like, how does that happen?
I don't think we were ever bad actors. In fact, we sort of missed the part where I started acting. It was when we had that sketch show with
Ryan right.
And,
yeah.
And with
so you
Robin.
Get some reps. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think I wanted to be on stage. I wanted to be strictly Larry David style writer. But there were a couple of characters that I would write and we would audition and nobody was doing it the way I heard it in my head. And mm-hmm. I was eventually like, it was actually my mom who was just like, you know, why are you hiding in plain sight? You should get out there and do it. You're funny. You make people laugh. And so that was the beginning of my acting. And then I signed up for Ivana Chubbuck. This is all like back in 2004, so we've jumped back quite a bit. But,
yeah, because I want to go to Marlon, yeah. Because I always say, like, I look at the actors and I'm just like, that's just so much better a job to just, it's just like, hand me the thing, I memorize it,
listen.
Tell me what shirt to wear, stand on the tape X, say the line, and go to my trailer and read.
Like,
I'd be very happy.
Listen, my old producer at Fallon, when he found out that I got the job on Marlon, he was like, you have the best job in Hollywood. He was like, to play the best friend on a sitcom. He was like, first off, Marlon's going to do all the craziest big thing. He was like, you just have to come in and essentially be like, you know, the straight man. And by the way, I think being the straight man is like both cool and like way harder than it looks. But he was like, you're never going to have a 5 a.m. call time because they don't do that in multicams. You just show up at work at about 9. They hand you the script. It's the same. It's made roughly the same pages as yesterday. You do the run through. You get a lunch. They bring in an audience. You come back. You say something funny. 200 people laugh at you. And then you all go to dinner at 8. Like, it's the best life. And oh, by the way, there's no flying across the country to Vancouver or to Atlanta. Like, you drive down the, you know, the 101 to the Universal lot.
Right.
You see all the people getting on the rides at Universal Studios. They wave at you when you walk in. Like, it's like magic. It's magic time. And I do say that, like, that is by far the most fun job I've ever had. Also, I was on a show with a great star, like Marlon Wayans. I've met a lot of famous people. Some are cool. Some are absolute weirdos. Some are deeply insecure and will make your life a living hell. Marlon is such a nice human being. Like, you know, he'll literally call me up sometimes and just say like, hey, you know, like, how was your kid's soccer game? Like, it's a weird level of nice, but it's just like, and he'll make fun of you. You know, he'll call you over to his house and like all the Wayanses are over there and it's like a roast. Like, all they're doing is making fun of you and everybody else in the room. But it is so familial. And I think because there's so many people there to keep everybody's egos in check, like, it's really just, you know, it's really one of the best friendships I've made, regardless of how famous the person was. Like, I think the world of that dude. And I'm always trying to figure out a new project for us to work on.
That's so cool. Well, you've been generous with your time. And I do want to talk about Southside, you know, before we go, because I started watching it and prep. And I remember, like, I saw a promo for it. And I remember in my head going, that looks really funny. And then I just like, I don't watch much TV and I forgot. But so I really like, I love these first two episodes I saw. I'm eager to dive in more. What was the genesis of that? Was it sort of like, looking at it, I was like, oh, I wonder if they went in and said, like, we have a version. It's sort of like a Black Office, but different or something. Like, because it was like the inner office comedy was great at the rent to own. But then there was like this family element. And then there were these cops who were sort of, what's the pitch on that?
Okay. So the pitch was simply, we're going to treat the South Side of Chicago like Springfield on The Simpsons. Okay. That was the pitch. I think they heard, you know, a rent-to-own store and thought, you know, oh, it's like a Black version
Superstore
of The Office.
Superstore or something, yeah.
Yeah, but if you watch, I really want you to watch the third episode. Because okay. The third episode is where you'll start to see how much we start expanding this place. You know, at the time, you got to remember, the South, Chicago and Atlanta, to a certain extent, are still used as a political football. Like, people are always like,
yes.
Well, what about Chicago? You know, like, anytime you talk about, like, gun control or anything like that. Bashir is from Chicago. Right after HBO passed on our Atlanta show, where I'm from, we were like, okay, let's do your hometown. Let's do some of these same ideas, because Atlanta and Chicago aren't drastically different, you know, places. And then we just started painting this world, you know, based on the... Because seriously, I hate it when people act like to grow up in Black neighborhoods or low-income Black neighborhoods is like to look out your door every day wondering if you're going to get shot or like, yeah. You know, I always have the sense sometimes executives wanted us to write a serious scene where like, you know, the mom is looking out the window and it's raining and she's like looking like sad but strong. Like we were like, we're not doing any of that shit.
Well, you went right at that in, I think it was, it might have been the first episode where they quit their job and kind of huff and then they go outside and they're shooting. It was just
because every now and then you want to make
which felt like The
like,
Simpsons.
Oh, wait, it can...
Yeah, like that felt like how they, what happened to Homer. Like, oh, you know, I quit. There's just shooting outside.
I'm telling you, if you like Angus and you like Mayor Quimby and you like that's how we really treat our show. And I really think, you know, I like to say that there's not, I don't think there's a weak episode of Southside. I really believe that. I think that every single episode, you know, I feel like it's
well,
a
the
show
cop
that's lost
who adopts the white kid named Josh too felt like very like that's some high level comedy Simpson. That,
by the way, that kid grew up so much by season two that you'll, if you make it to season two, you'll love how we treat that character in season two. Look, I mean, like, you've got politicians and cops. You've got people who work at a rent-to-own store. You've got, you know, the mom. We do so much with the mom who's has two sons. One is a great science student, and the other one might play in the NBA. So the one who might play in the NBA gets all the love. You know, like, it's just, it's one of those kind of shows where I just
Her introduction was great when it was like, I know you have questions. Yes, I dated Eddie Curry. I mean, the Eddie Curry reference alone, I was like, that's so funny.
Because
it's like just a notorious
kind of tell folks where we can watch Southside.
It's on HBO Max. And I'm just going to put this out there, not to say they're right about everything, but the New York Times did say that Southside was one of the best shows of 2023. Which we're very proud of.
That's amazing.
Nice. I think all three seasons are good. So just give the first episode a watch. I guarantee you'll watch the whole thing.
I second that. I just have to ask because it, you know, I know on these shows, especially when you're shooting single cam, like everyone just always says budget. But it seems like you really stretch the budget. Like to me, it's sort of like watching a movie and some of the clever stuff you do with video. So I don't know if you could talk a little bit on, like, is that planned in the writing or is that stuff you're finding after you have the script? You go, like, write whatever you want and we'll find a way to do it.
Yeah, we typically write whatever we want. And at some point we're like, okay, we can't have 32 setups. You know, we got to get this down to 20. You know, we still shoot more than we need, but, you know, we're very hard on ourselves in the editing process. And I will say that show was not, you know, very expensive. We, you know, as you can attest, We have almost no famous people on the show. Like it's the whole cast. Like we went to Chicago, we cast local Chicago actors. We had Lil Rel pop in because he's a friend of ours. You know,
yeah.
Chance the Rapper shows up in season two because he's a friend of ours. Everybody who's making the scale. And honestly, the only reason Chance even shows up in seasons two and three is because he saw season one, reached out to Lil Rel, and he was like, "Yo, this is the funniest shit." He was like, "How come I even haven't heard of this show?" And so. Through Lil Rel, he reached out to us and he was like, dude, I just write me a part. I would definitely come through and do it. He's like, I haven't seen anybody actually depict what it's like to live in Chicago. Even though it's called Southside, we go to Roscoe Village. We go to Wrigleyville. Like, we go all over the city.
Yeah.
But we really wanted to make it clear that, like, the Southside is not the hellhole that politicians and the media would have you believe. And, you know, there's a reason why people, you meet people from Chicago. They're like, I love Chicago. I can't wait to go back. Like, they wouldn't be like that if it was a nightmare town.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, and I feel like the North Side has always had Bill Murray and the Cubs and the John Hughes movies, but like the South Side has never really gotten its fair share. So that was another reason why we really wanted to. We wanted to do a show that would make you feel like you knew what it was like to live in the South Side of Chicago or Southwest Atlanta or South Philly or South Central. We always joke that we could have done a South universe and just gone to
Well, you might.
City.
I mean, that's, you know, that's how it happens.
Yeah, I learned mostly about that from through Bad Leroy Brown. So I need an updating in my history of that area.
Well, I'll heartily recommend the show Southside, your XM, Sirius XM show. One Song is just one of my favorites. And I thank you so much for joining us today, man. It was great talking to you, Diala.
I really appreciate it. And guys, seriously, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Diallo is so cool. Just so cool. So interesting. Awesome. Really great. Goldie, you ran a great interview with him. That was really fun. I feel like I just sort of was a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. All right. Now let's get into a part of the show that we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Beautiful Bluetooth, take us away. Goldie, this was your category. Tell us what we're top five and about.
The top five things you miss from childhood.
Aww. I miss those things.
Yeah. Number five for me was biking everywhere.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Nice. Just hopping on your dirt bike and going to friends unannounced.
Yep, butts up in the air biking.
Mm-hmm. Number four was never thinking about dinner. Who was going to make it.
Mild overlap.
Or
mild
any overlap. Meals or any food.
That's a major overlap. Yep.
Number three for me was renting videos.
That's nice.
I want to go back and rewrite because that's a good one.
Not having infinite choices at your disposal, but going somewhere, seeing what was there.
Yeah.
And making do.
If you lucked into a new release,
yep,
you watched it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Number two. So great. Was I miss when bubblegum was king.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yes.
When maybe you would ride your bike 3 miles to go buy some grape bubblicious.
Yes.
Or some tropical hubba bubba.
Hubba
bubba.
And the number one thing I miss, my dad.
Oh, major overlap. I'm just kidding. all right, I'll wedge mine in the middle here, Mr. Wedgley-Dale. Number five for me, things I miss from my childhood, mandatory naps.
Ooh, that's nice.
I miss that. God, that was such a great time of day. Number four, the smell of Play-Doh.
Oh.
You can have that.
I know, but I feel weird about it. As the kids say, it doesn't hit the same. All right. number three, here's our overlap, having every meal prepared for me.
Yes,
great. Number two, the last day of school.
Oh.
Oh, God, was that fun. So fun.
Yeah, because work, it's like, oh, you have a break, but you're coming back in like a week.
I don't have that.
I know. Yeah, no, the summer, last day of school before summer is excellent. And number one, my birthday. The way that I used to feel about my birthday was just so different. You know, the great cakes you would get as a kid, the little parties you would have with your
the
friends.
Excitement.
And now it's like, you know, we it's well documented on here. My 50th was a debacle.
Oh, no.
So they're just not getting better. And they'll never be what they were.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. Okay.
JC, what do you got?
Great lists. My number five, not having to pay bills.
Yeah.
Those days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Number four, having summers off.
Yeah.
Yes, which is like the last days.
Yeah, summer. But
number three, having bounds of energy.
Yes. Oh.
Number two, here's our all crossover.
Yep.
Having meals made for you.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, the best.
And number one, being carried.
Out of E.T., maybe.
Yeah,
I missed that.
You mean Stu's not throwing you over his shoulder?
Yeah. Maybe the other way around. Let's go, honey.
That's awesome. All right, JC, what do you got for next week? By the way, next week, our guest is going to be John Beckerman.
Yes.
A Letterman legend, John Beckerman. Yes. He was doing it when we were struggling. So we can't wait to talk to him.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Yeah. So, and next week's top five, it's sort of like the opposite of one I'd done before. This is top five words or phrases to yell or scream.
Oh, I like that.
You did whisper.
I like that. Yell or scream. Love that. All right. So we look forward to that. John Beckerman in that top five next week. Sounds very cool. And now let's end the show, as we always do, on a high note. Oh, a little long. Goldie, why don't you go first today?
My high note was Hanukkah.
Yes.
And a Hanukkah celebration we had at our house with neighborhood people.
Nice.
I just think in these times, it was the meaning of it was a lot more profound than it's been in the past years.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Very nice. Very nice. Well said. My high note is this weekend is our co-podcaster's birthday.
Oh.
On Sunday. We're very excited that he's in another year around the sun or whatever the fuck, however that works. But Goldie, you're an awesome guy. Happy birthday. You make this show sing, and we appreciate it.
I think everything was false that you said, except that it's my birthday.
Well, that's part of my high note.
Yeah.
Birthday boy.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Goldie. Mm. You are a treasure.
Yes.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Yeah, you are very loved by both of us in this
treasure,
room.
Treasure, you should be buried at sea.
I walked into that one.
Yeah.
And I'm sure our friends and listeners feel the same way.
Yeah.
So happy Thanks. Birthday.
They better. All right. Oh, hey, that's it for this week. All right. Well, that was a fun show. Thank you all for listening. Thank you two for being
Thank
awesome.
You.
Goldie, happy birthday.
Happy
and
birthday.
We will talk to you again next week.
I thought it was my birthday, so I would think next week I could get. All right.
We're going to need you here.
That was fun.
We did it.
And it stops right now.
Oh, Fraud Stewart.